All right, paper 32, section 2, which is old single column, page 358. And before we get started directly with this, I'm going to read some paragraphs to kind of get us spun up again. Because these first two sections of this paper really are a pair, where they're focusing on a lot of the astronomy, related issues. So we kind of need to get ourselves into that mode again. If you want, first thing I want to read is the paragraph that's back in paper 15. On old single column, page 169, paper 15, section 4, paragraph 6. It's the bottom of page 169 in the single column. It's the paragraph that I referred to in passing last week, where they mention the 1/100,000th ratio. Again, so it'll besides allowing you to actually see that literally what I was referring to, it also gives you a little appropriate context here. So we're thinking about very much the physical aspects of a local universe coming into existence. There is basically nothing fiat about that process. This is a very long-term evolutionary process. Yes, there are beings involved, like force organizers to initiate whirls for nebulae and things like that. But by and large, it's a long temporal evolutionary process to bring a local universe into place for a creator son and creator mother spirit to engage. So, that's why you see this paragraph starts out with nebula, or nebulae. Nebulae are not directly related to any of the administrative units, such as minor sectors or local universes. Although some local universes have been organized from the products of a single nebula, each local universe embraces exactly 1/100,000th part of the total energy charge of a super universe, irrespective of nebular relationship. For energy is not organized by nebulae, it is universally distributed. Okay, see, so there's that. Like I said, when you're talking about the energy charge of the super universe, then it's exactly 1/100,000th. Whereas we were seeing up there in paper 32, they kept saying approximately because they're tying it to energy potential, to force. Okay, but you might ask, why do they, mention minor sectors and local universes in the context of thinking astronomically, nebulae, it's because both of those subdivisions do end up being kind of a star cloud, quote unquote. A roughly delineated region that if you were to, look down upon it, you could distinguish. The minor sector sort of being that basic clumpiness that you would see within the major sectors of a super universe, a basic star cloud, a massive clump of stars that is orbiting, revolving around and around the center of the galaxy. In our case, that center that's in the direction of the constellation Sagittarius. So, You know, so, you know, in the big space around us, you know, beyond what we can see with the naked eye, there's this massive grouping of stars. It's our minor sector that's going around and around the Milky Way. But within that minor sector are 100 local universes, and each of those local universes, by construct, becomes roughly individuated as well, because we were talking about that the power beings have to hold the physical elements of a local universe together. You can't have an inhabited world of one local universe drifting out into some other local universe. You know, so all the primary matter has to be held there. So that's obviously going to produce a rough boundary of some sort. You know, I'm sure it's not spherical or anything by and large. Who knows what shapes these things have to take? But it's going to, there's going to be a center of gravity for a local universe, and a center of gravity for a minor sector, so that they have a relationship to what an astronomer would be thinking about in terms of some sort of physical system. It's, you know, it's going to be a quote-unquote physical system because gravity has somehow delineated it in some way from other things. And so they both have that. So they're saying, yes, they're, but it's in neither case, because local universes are basically artificially constructed and they're the components of a minor sector, in neither case did this just coincidentally end up like this because of gravity and sloshing about. Okay? You had a question?
Yeah, quick question. So is this saying that a nebula could in fact be in more than one local universe?
Okay, so yeah, so let's speak to that.
I didn't quite understand.
Yeah, okay, so the one hand there, they say, in contrast, there's a subtext there, is in contrast to Nebadon, there are times when you have a big enough spiral galaxy that's spun up outside of the Milky Way and then brought in, that all the stars that nebula ends up producing are plenty of stars to form a local universe out of, you know, with just one physical system generating stars. In the case of Nebadon, that's not the case. We have multiple physical systems. And a lot of times, you can be guaranteed, when things are brought into the Milky Way, the tidal forces and whatnot disrupt that galaxy extensively, you know, so that the stars from that galaxy end up getting spread over a lot of space. You know, and so when all is said and done, some of those stars are in this, end up in that local universe, some end up in this one. I mean, obviously that's more likely if it's a really big system to start with than a little one like the Andromeda Nebula, you know, that's not even close to being big enough for a whole local universe. Okay, the little nebula that produced our star and a million others. Yeah, well, I mean, and nothing is as big as Andromeda, which is in the first outer space level, and basically Andromeda is the size of a whole super universe. See, that's the thing about, yeah, I mean, if you look, it just says point blank that Andromeda it's actually two ships passing in the night. You know, it's going the other direction, this way, but Andromeda is the size of all those big spiral galaxies in the outer space levels. You know, in other words, those are the basic building blocks out there. The basic building blocks out there are the size of the biggest thing in the super universe level. So you start where the super universe level ends out there. Okay? In here, the basic building blocks, you know, are much smaller.
Yep. And that's where science is currently very, very confused, because it just in terms of scale, we keep trying to look at the Milky Way and compare it to things out there, when in fact, you know, our super universe level is made up of tiny, tiny little pieces that are like that stuff out there.
Right. You know, there must, you know, obviously the way they describe our super universe, the force organizers apparently established some sort of a background whirl, you know, that's Milky Way sized, you know, that's like Andromeda and whatnot sized. And then, but it's sort of the context, really, within which little systems are incorporated. You know, because you want all those little systems to end up in this one turning, you know, a universe mode. So there's some sort of a background structure. I mean, they tell you, you know, you literally have the spiral coils coming out of the center, you know. So it has some of the basics, but you have all of these little objects that are brought in, countless numbers of them, and then all of that's hyper-micromanaged. So right now, if you were to look down on it, it wouldn't look like just some big, stupendous coils like we see out in the outer space levels. That's the background of the Milky Way galaxy. That's the background of each of the seven super-universe galaxies. That's not the, you know, like I said, that's not the foreground phenomenon. And let's just say it that way. I mean, the foreground phenomenon, like Andre was just saying, are these little things that you're building little local universe size chunks out of. So that's the basic, you know, picture. And then the question is, well, what's kind of some of the time scales of all this? And we'll get to that when we read when we're reading in paper 32 tonight. But notice just that last line of, for energy is not organized by nebulae, it is universally distributed. See, that's related to like what I was just saying about the fact that you've got a background, you know, in which all these little things are being drawn. So you have this, you know, universal, not to mention throughout the whole segment of the super universe level that is a particular super universe, there's matter and energy strewn all over that area, all over that volume. When they spin up whirls out there outside of the Milky Way, I mean, there's stray stuff that, you know, gets spread out all over the place, not to mention stuff that drifts out of the Milky Way proper. And, you know, so the whole volume is filled with matter, that a lot of which is a pretty, you know, untended. But sometime in the distant future, you know, it won't just be the big stuff that they will be micromanaging. They'll eventually get down to the last single automaton, and every single automaton will be put precisely in its place in the grand universe of settled inline life. You know, there's no stray particles in Havona. Everything has its perfect place. Okay? It may be very dynamic. You know, its place may be, you know, a dynamic element. You know, don't think statically, but still, it has a definitive place.
Okay? With the Owl of Paradise, if, you know, I'm always going to ask about this, but if the Owl of Paradise is in every automaton, because when you just said that, it made me think, and you said eventually there won't be, you know, won't be haphazard, it'll all be, okay, well, if it's already, Owl of Paradise is already in every automaton, then everything would be connected and everything would be grounded. Anyway,
right, right. See, right. See, so that's that relationship to the aisle, the one aisle. See, is an obvious potential for order in the physical. You just have to combine that with the recognition it's an evolutionary universe. So it's not an actuality of instant absolute order. The aisle is slowly being brought into relationship with the finite. You know, so order is slowly crystallizing. You know, so that's kind of a fascinating thing. It's absolute. The aisle's not changing. So to think about that clutch, you know, that slippage that exists between the absoluteness of the aisle and what starts out as basically chaos, and is slowly becoming cosmos, more and more universally, more and more order. You know, that's because the aisle can, is slowly being allowed to take its proper place and role. And it's like, well, how could that be? The aisle is absolute. How could there be something that's regulating it? Remember, all these power beings that we're talking about, high and low, have super absolute natures. So, I mean, at the top of all of that, the universal manipulator, the third source and center, has a super absolute nature that overrules the immediate imposition of the absoluteness of the aisle. It fuzzes it out and holds it fuzzed out above the ability of the aisle to lock it into pattern. And it's slowly being allowed to crystallize in relationship to the aisle. I mean, you can think of the aisle as the crystallizing agent, and the pattern for that crystal sees the central universe. The aisle is that influence that brings the raw material into a crystallized relationship relative to the pattern universe. Okay, so the other little paragraph related to this, so that one's just kind of purely material. If you go to paper 21, on page 235 in the single column, paper 21, section 2, paragraph 1, and we read this a while back. Let's bring this in. A little bit of what the Creator Son is doing in relationship to things here. Okay, so that I'll just read that whole paragraph. The Paradise Sons of the primary order are designers, creators, builders, and administrators of their respective domains, the local universes of time and space, the basic creative units of the seven evolutionary super universes. A Creator Son is permitted to choose the space site of his future cosmic activity, but before he may begin even the physical organization of his universe, he must spend a long period of observation devoted to the study of the efforts of his older brothers in various creations located in the super universe of his projected action. And prior to all this, the Michael Son will have completed his long and unique experience of paradise observation and Havona training. So there's that long period when he's on the Isle of Paradise and he's relating to the central universe. At the same time that the creative spirit is still inside of the infinite spirit, that long period. But then when they actually go out, they're reminding you here, he doesn't just immediately start doing everything the moment that the two of them get out there. There's a long period of observation out there, and it's like, well, what do we know that supplies the block of time where there could be a long period of observation? We know that the two of them arrived out here 300 billion years ago. Okay, and we also know that you didn't have the first inhabited world until 200 billion years ago. So there's 100 billion years in which there can be lots and lots of observation, and then finally, you know, really getting the finishing touches done on all the physical structure, and then getting all the beings created and getting all the beings put in place. And you have that long span of 100 billion years, plenty of space to fit, you know, a word like long period in somewhere. I mean, I don't know how long long period is, but there's obviously 100 billion years to play with there. So, you know, there's space. That's one of the things that's going on during that time. He's out there, you know, in situ, you know, observing what's going on in this super universe and what the other Creator Sons are doing to be part of the greater organization of the Seventh Master Spirit and the Master Architects, you know, over it all. Okay. So just wanted to, you know, give you that. You know, since we read it a long time ago, but now we're kind of putting it more in place, and actually thinking about this local universe coming into existence.
Chris, what about the first guys? One of our first ones to come out, and
yes,
they don't have as many places to go look at. Actually.
They right. So you think about those first ones; they're very they're going to be a very close, immediate like expression to the first Michael, you know, the first Creator Son, firstborn Michael's son, you know, in Havona, and what that, you know, we don't know the details of that relationship. But obviously, those first Creator sons would be sort of taking the first little gentle steps of pattern expression out here, not far removed from the source pattern, you know. And so it you see how it kind of can't help but be top down in its formation. The first ones would be really close to the top, to the central universe, and then you're slowly moving down into the trenches and by the time you get to our Creator Son, you know, he has that whole structure above him that's been laid, you know, down, and they're working towards. So in many ways, see the Supreme, you can see the Supreme coming into existence top down like that. Okay. Let's see. Was there anything else there? The main thing was I just wanted to make sure that, you know, you appreciated that, you know, they say, and prior to all this, he's on paradise, you know, because when they're talking about that, he's out here, you know, doing this observation. Because the way it works, I mean, there's just a short period of time once they, if you remember when we went through the Supreme Spirits and talking about a creative spirit becoming a creative mother spirit, that whole process, seven-stage process. Once Michael picks, the creative spirit gets flavored by the particular master spirit, you know, and it's a fairly, you know, relatively short process, and, you know, and then they head out. He's not there still on the aisle for some long period of observation. I mean, it's, you know, he's done with his paradise observation. He's going to be observing out here, that second phase of observation. But, now we're going to move to the next stage. Just notice, you know, when they say designers, creators, builders, and administrators, you know, especially the creators and builders, okay, you got to take that in the proper context. Don't think, you know, that a Creator Son makes everything. He and the Creative Mother Spirit come in to put the finishing touches on a local universe. All of the basic stuff is done by the power beings, long before Michael, you know, gets there, even long before our Creator Son picks, you know, any local universe. You have this very lengthy process. It's in the hands of the power beings following the plans of the master architects. Okay, so the plans of a Creator Son don't come in until, you know, the later stages of the physical development. All of the basic stuff are not Creator Son plans. They're Master Architect plans. Okay, in that mode, if you just look back at the so back to paper 32, that what we read last time in that first section. So just look at those first two paragraphs of the first section. They're on page 357 in a single column. In that first paragraph of section one, I just want you to notice the second word where it says pre-universe. Okay? And then let me read the second paragraph. These power directors function alone in the pre-material and post-force phases of a local universe creation. There is no opportunity for a Creator Son to begin universe organization until the power directors have effected the mobilization of the space energy sufficiently to provide a material foundation. Literal suns and material spheres for the emerging universe. Okay, so two things in there I wanted to stress up front. They give you, so you notice here they said local universe creation relative to what the power beings are doing before a creator sun. So, and then they said pre-universe before that. So what they want you to be thinking is, take a really long time scale of at least a trillion years, where you're thinking pre-universe, quote-unquote, where you have these little nebulae that are outside of the disk of the Milky Way that are being formed, or automatons are becoming particles or becoming stars. You have this whole formation of a budding little galaxy. All this material is being brought into the Milky Way. That's a whole pre-universe, quote-unquote, pre-local universe phase of the evolution of what's going to eventually be the physical part of a local universe. Once you have material that's down and very roughly coordinated into the disk of the Milky Way, into the super universe proper, there's some point at which they really start kind of effectively thinking of it as a local universe. They've kind of basically roughed it out. It's going to be this part of that nebula and then these three little nebulae, or, you know, whatever. You know, and that's going to be this local universe. They've got it basically segregated from the other material. Okay, so at some point there, it's enough of a separate and individuated phenomenon that you can effectively call it a local universe now, even though there isn't a creator son and a creator mother spirit there yet. Okay, and that's that. Where that there's some long period of time, which they're about to give us specifics on when we start reading. Some long period of time where the power directors see function alone in creation, quote unquote. You know, like I said, they're the hands following the plans of the architects. Okay, but it's spoken of as a creation of a local universe, and there's no creator son involved. Okay, so this long managed evolutionary process. Okay, and so now we're ready to get to section two here. So let's start reading, and you'll see they fill in a little bit more of these details and stress this element of how the Creator Son is definitely coming in subservient to a long process before them. There was one other thing I wanted to mention, just because it can be confusing. The other thing in that second paragraph of section one, see when they say literal suns and material spheres, okay, so it can be confusing when we start reading here. Don't think that you just have amorphous energy or diffuse matter and then the creator sun comes in and really starts to, ball it up into dirt clods, making stars and stuff. I mean, there's lots and lots of stars and planets, all kinds of dark islands of space. There's all kinds of very macroscopic, literal things in place before a creator sun comes out. So he's not even just working with diffuse raw material. A lot of it is basically a finished product, and he's going to work on the arrangement and stuff. Okay. Now, a creative arrangement, see? He's a creator in that mode. So let's read a little.
2, universe organization. The creator sons are preceded in universe organization by the power directors and other beings originating in the third source and center. From the energies of space, thus previously organized, Michael, your creator son, established the inhabited realms of the universe of Nebadon, and ever since has been painstakingly devoted to their administration. From pre-existent energy, these divine suns materialize visible matter, project living creatures, and with the cooperation of the universe presence of the infinite spirit, create a diverse retinue of spirit personalities.
Yeah, retinue, assistance, retained retinue. Right, so just that little line, that the whole point of most of these beings that the two of them are going to create is just to be assistance. all those quote-unquote spirit beings. Ascenders is a separate issue. Okay, but notice, like I said, that from pre-existent energy, these divine sons materialize visible matter. Yes, but see, don't overplay that. That's why I was wanting to make sure you remembered what was up front there. There's a lot of stuff that's been very definitively materialized before they get there. Okay, but obviously, if you're going to put the finishing touches on things, there could be materialization. You know, if you're going to put plaster on the walls, okay, the walls can all be there, but then you materialize the plaster and put it on the walls. Okay, so so it's basically evolution. Normal physical evolution can build the stars and the planets. You know, the architectural worlds, okay, yeah, they have to, you know, they're built all, you know, from scratch, artificially. But the builder, you know, of most of it physically is gravity. It's the aisle. The aisle is building it. Okay. Let's see, anything else there? Now let's read some more. Oh, okay. Yep.
Why does the word project living creatures?
That's a word that's rooted in the architects above creator sons, architects of all types that are like we've been seeing. This whole phenomenon is coming from the top down. So they use that word project to think of a source on high, you know, and a cone, you know, projecting, just like when we think of a slide projector, you know, we think of that light fanning out from the lens and spreading out to a whole wide screen, you know, projecting like that, okay? So that's the image they want you to paint, that there's a transcendent source on high that's projecting down. The life is all, not, you know, it's not just the physical elements, but all life has its source pattern in the pattern universe as well. So in some sense, see, you're projecting the pattern universe out, both physically and in terms of living beings. You're projecting that out into a much vaster sevenfold expression of that very localized central universe. So the word project is tied in the revelation, it's tied to capacity. The idea that you are going to project from a source into a capacity, into a volume, okay, and fill it.
Yeah, I think, remember, they get all their ideas from the billion perfect worlds that they, you know, and so therefore...
And the beings on them.
Right, the beings on them. Yeah, so yeah. In this case, you know, they may say, okay, so they're going to project which kind of beings perhaps they're going to do from, you know, all the information they have and sort of say, okay, well, these are the kinds of beings, because I'm sure, you know, the different creator sons have different kinds of beings
right.
in different universes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and the key with that, they don't have, you know, infinite leeway, because, well, you know, the most literal linkage in this projection is for each Havona world that's projected out as seven local systems, one in each super universe. You know, so the local system of Satania is a projection of a particular, a specific Havona world, not all of them, one Havona world. Okay. So he's, you know, there's 10,000 local systems. So my particular creator son is projecting 10,000 Havona worlds out into his local universe. Okay. Let's see. All right. Let's see. I'll get some more here.
These power directors and energy controllers, who long preceded the Creator Son in the preliminary physical work of universe organization, later serve in magnificent liaison with this Universe Son, forever remaining in associated control of those energies which they originally organized and circuitized. On Salvington, there now function the same 100 power centers who cooperated with your Creator Son in the original formation of this local universe.
Okay, so just back when we were doing paper 29, remember when we were going through the hierarchy of the centers, the supreme power centers, and we had the local universe centers. So here we're seeing them in action, and they're giving you a little bit more. They're not just these anchor points in the energy distribution grid that are put in place once all of the stages, once all the physical foundation is laid. They're actually out there in the trenches helping to get that foundation upon which they're going to stand forever laid. Okay, so that they're adding that little tidbit. It's the same 100 power centers here now. We're helping get things together back then. And in that regard, you remember when we were doing that, we recognized why there's 100, because there's 100 constellations, that you have this very direct distribution grid from one local universe capital. You're linking directly to each of the 100 constellations. Yeah, so you have one. You need one power center for each constellation. That the fact that they're so intimate, you know, in the whole process, you know, even before Michael gets there, Michael and the Creative Mother Spirit get there, it's no wonder that up in paper 57, like I was pointing to last week, you know, that's that. You don't have to turn there, but I'll just for sake of the recording, it's on single column page 654. In paper 57, section 3, what I was referring to when they're talking about 400 billion years ago, 300 billion years ago, 200 billion years ago, up there, they tell you that the architectural worlds for the local universe capital and all of the constellations were all started at the same time, right at the beginning. So you can understand a little bit more directly why all the constellations would be, they would start building those at the same time they start building Salvington and the satellites. Because, see, you have these 100 power centers that are going to be linking to those 100 constellations. See, it's very much a package deal here, see, that you're getting in place. You have to not only get the center, but the 100 constellations laid out, because it's really an extension of the center. So that's all 101 of those architectural systems are... they start building them all at the same time. Okay. All right, so let's get to the next thing. So now here's this next one is where they give us some specifics on that whole long process before the Creator Son and the Creator Mother Spirit show up.
The first completed act of physical creation in Nebadon consisted in the organization of the headquarters world, the architectural sphere of Salvington, with its satellites. From the time of the initial moves of the power centers and the physical controllers to the arrival of the living staff on the completed spheres of Salvington, there intervened a little over 1 billion years of your present planetary time. The construction of Salvington was immediately followed by the creation of the 100 headquarters worlds of the projected constellations, and the 10,000 headquarters spheres of the projected local systems of planetary control and administration, together with their architectural satellites. Such architectural worlds are designed to accommodate both physical and spiritual personalities, as well as the intervening morantia or transition stages of being.
Okay. All right, so again, you have that pre-universe stage, which, you know, it's at least a trillion years. You know, you say on the order, think of something on the order of a trillion for that whole slow process of getting stuff really kind of down into the super universe proper, in our case, down into the disk of the Milky Way proper. And at some point, like I said, you know, it's effectively a local universe now, instead of a pre-universe situation. And here they're telling you how long that is. So up, like I was saying, the rest of this story is up in paper 57, and they tell you that we also read it last time at the end of the previous section, that as soon as the Creator Son and Creator Mother Spirit arrive, they start building the constellation headquarters and this local universe headquarters, and it takes a million years for them to build those. It takes a million years for them to build those. From the time, immediately, you know, from the time when the Creator Son and the Creator Mother Spirit arrive. Okay, so how long before they arrive are the power beings alone in that quote-unquote local universe getting things ready? You've got to get it so that when you start building these architectural worlds, that they're ready to be connected into the whole super universe grid. See, so here they're telling you. So you got about a trillion years for things to kind of get collected. And once it's collected, then there's about a billion years where the power beings are getting it basically in place. And then there's a million years from the time the Creator Son and Creator Mother Spirit arrive that they're building the 101 architectural systems for the constellations in the local universe capital. And here, you know, they point out, which is probably kind of obvious, that if they start building all 101 of those, they're going to complete the local universe capital first. I mean, after all, there's only 491 worlds there. You know, in just one local system, there's 771. You know, so in all 100, you have 77,100 architectural worlds that have to be built for those constellations. Okay, but you know, that's basically 77,500 worlds. I mean, in a million years, and they're huge. Remember, they're huge. I mean, when you're talking about, take a constellation, you know, the sub-satellites are the size of the Earth. The satellites, you know, and there's 70 of them. Those are the size of Jupiter. You know, 10 times as big as the Earth in diameter. You know, 100 times in area. Okay. And then the central world is 100 times the diameter of the Earth. It's the size of the Sun, right? And so you're building, you know, you have to build all of those massive worlds, in just a million years. It's actually pretty amazing, you know. A million years seems. Right.
You gotta put them in the right place.
And you gotta be right. They have to all be in the place and all this and connected into the super universe and all this. But, you know, they spent a billion years getting everything ready so that they could just go at it building, you know, without any precursor.
You call them massive, but isn't the effect of gravity in each one approximately the same?
Right. But, I'm giant in scope. Is what I meant by massive, obviously. Yeah, they aren't. Now, what element of that gravity is innate in the structure, in the lightness, quote unquote, of the structure, and what element of that roughly Earth gravity is the anti-gravity presence of the beings there, negating? See, we don't know. We don't know how much it's a porous, you know, or whatnot structure so that it can have low gravity innately, and how much they have to be actively, every instant, negating a lot of gravity to give it roughly one Earth's gravity. You know, they don't explain that. If they have to negate a lot, they can easily do that. You're talking about all these, you know, massive power beings, they can negate, you know, a lot more than anything that's in play there. They have plenty of anti-gravity ability to do that. So, So that's, it's fun to clear that up. So see, it's the billion and the million. So you don't, you know, you got to keep that straight. That's why I've been spending so much time here. That there's this whole, so now you know how long that time is before the Your sun. It's, you know, in the scale of a million years to get the architectural worlds, you know, it's 1,000 times longer, you know, before the Creator Son and the Creator Mother Spirit get there, that you really have kind of, you know, there is a local universe, you know, that you could point to, but there's no Creator Son and Creator Mother Spirit there. For basically a billion years, you've got that sort of a phenomenon that's getting roughed out. All right. Let's see. What else do we have in there? Okay, yeah, then, oh yeah, they... So, and the other thing that, you know, the rest of the story that they tell you up in paper 57, like I mentioned last time, the, you know, they tell you they start working on the local system headquarters worlds, you know, all 57 of them in each, for each local system. But that, you know, is not done in a million years. And it's not just because, you know, you have so many of them to do. You know, 10,000 times 57 is a big number. right. You got a lot of architectural worlds to build for the local system. But it's spread out over a very long period of time. They tell you the last ones were built about 5 billion years ago. So from 300 billion years ago until 5 billion years ago, they were building local system architectural worlds. And it spread out over such a long length of time because, for instance, our local system probably wasn't ready to have a headquarters built until about then. The Andromeda Nebula wasn't really done making its million stars until about 6 billion years ago. So, you know, you don't even have the rough material yet to be collecting into a local system until, you know, just a few billion years ago. So that's why... you know, those would be built until just 5 billion years ago. And that also, like I said last time, that tells you that, see, we're one of the youngest local systems. You know, the youngest one is basically 5 billion years ago, and, you know, we can't be much older than that. So, yeah.
Yeah, and the concept of building them, you know, think about it, because it's not evolution.
Right.
They're not being built by mountains wearing down or rivers coming out. You know, they're actually, somebody's doing the work.
Automaton by automaton,
yeah,
those beings are just in their presence.
Is it kind of like magical, or is it actually physically somebody?
Yeah, that says in their presence. You know, remember how they tell you these beings have a dynamic, active presence. You know, don't think of them as a being that's standing right there. You know, they're a vast being, these power beings, and so they have they occupy a vast space, and within their volume, they just crystallize automatons into what they want. The automatons just obey their mind, you know, as it were. You know, follow their spirit, you know, engagement, and are just assembled into a structure.
Yeah, it takes a while.
And yeah. You can imagine just how complicated it is, because it's literally automatonic precision. You know, this automaton's got to go there. This one's got to go there. And you got this thing that's the size of the sun. You know, and it has, I mean, you can just imagine how complex, you know, how complex the plumbing and everything is, you know, as it were, you know, of one of these worlds. Because, you know, it all just has to be done. Yeah. So, you know, you think an aircraft carrier has a lot of parts to assemble. Imagine one of these architectural worlds. How many little parts, you know, every building and everything, I mean, everything is all assembled, you know. So it's just, yeah. But see, the only way, obviously, you could possibly do that is if you somehow can just animate the matter in your presence. And so the whole, you know, pool of countless automatons just, you know, begin to dance in your presence and come together. You know, if you had to pick up this thing and stick, you know, if you had to build it like with bricks, you know, I mean, you couldn't, it'd take forever. It's too much action. So you have to do it very holistically, you know. Yeah, they can be very creative. Yeah.
Or are they,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, they have to be creative because they have to be able to follow the plans, first of the architects and then of the Creator Son and Creator Mother Spirit, precisely. You know, the Creator Son says, I want this architectural sphere to be like this. You know, it's a 6 quintillion page plan, you know, blueprint, you know, and they have to follow every page of it. Every single, you know, every world is different. And the Creator Son, see, you know, is responsible for the exact details of every single world, all those thousands upon thousands of architectural worlds. And every local universe is different. So if you go to a different local universe, that creator sun had a completely different design for every one of those architectural worlds than here.
When you say that it just comes together like a dance, is that some type of vocalization?
Right. See, you can see how mother-like the phenomenon. See, it's a very holistic. You're using the focalization aspect that they have in relationship to the mother. You know, they have a relationship to capacity and that projection. They have a relationship to see focalization. You know, a totality attitude. All these things. See, you know, they're applying in a very holistic way.
Chris.
Yep. That's all back in paper 29, okay, where they go through all that. The force organizers are very high absentite beings. The master physical controllers are the lowest of the finite power beings. But you will use the word master high and low because they all embody a transcendent ability to engage the finite. This whole bit we were talking about with bringing the aisle, allowing the aisle in. If they didn't have to synchronize things with the evolution of the Supreme, they could bring the aisle in like that. They are the conduits, you know, to express the pattern of the aisle. They could do it by fiat in a moment. The entire grand universe would just go click and crystallize, okay? But they're a governor. They're, you know, they're letting it in slowly. They have to keep that, allowing that absoluteness to come in slowly in step with the Supreme. They're in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity, everyone involved. See, that's the whole thing about the fifth epical revelation. That's what it's all about. Unlike anything that anyone has ever thought before. The whole universe, from the Universal Father down to me, and every ultimate, everything is in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity. That's the fundamental difference between the fifth epical revelation and anything else. That's what's different. It's not everything in cooperative subordination to God the Almighty, you know, or something like this, you know. You know, God the Father, or you know, even. It's all about the Paradise Trinity. That's what's fundamentally different. Never has this been revealed before. That's what everything is underneath. That's the ceiling under which all things exist. That's the whole. Humans have always thought of the universe as a collection of parts with a lot of really active intervention to keep the parts, you know, arranged properly. They've never tried to think about a universe that just innately has a whole, that just is. Paradise Trinity is existential, just is. And everything puts itself in cooperative subordination because of free will. Yeah. So what the Father gives you is the opportunity to put yourself in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity by giving you free will. The same thing that he has, and you're going to do the same thing with it that he did. Put himself in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity. Everything comes under the one whole. No part is the whole. Not even the infinite parts are the whole. The Father is just a part. You know, no one has ever tried to understand the universe like that. That's the fundamental difference about the fifth epical revelation. Okay, let's see. Is there anything else in there? You can see it's a big paragraph. You know, it invokes a lot of thoughts. Oh, yeah, the very last thing. That's right, the transition there at the end. So not only do they have to think about this architectural world relative to just the immediate material physical issues. But the automatons have to be arranged just so to relate to all kinds of spirit beings, high and low. And the automatons have to be arranged to relate to all types of Maranja beings. Because all beings, you know, and all power, and everything has to be circuited and grounded within this architectural sphere. See, so they have a very transcendent understanding of matter. And that's why they call, you know, our minor sector Ensa. They use the word you can look up in the dictionary, Ents. That innate fundamental beingness is what that word means. When you get to the minor sector level, these power beings are going to teach you the fundamental nature of being, how all things are grounded, all spirit, all mind, everything is grounded in matter, that it's the foundation of all being, of all existence. Even the Universal Father can only exist because he's grounded on matter. He puts himself in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity above and immovably plants his feet in the Paradise Isle below and exists between those two plates, you know, those two boundary conditions. He cannot move because the Isle is stationary. The Isle rules him. The Isle says you can't move, therefore he doesn't. And the Paradise Trinity says this is what the whole looks like. And he says, yes, I put myself in cooperative subordination to that. You know, so his actions are predicated on the Paradise Trinity and his feet are planted in the immovable Isle. He's not the first word. Might be the last word, you know, in a sense, but he's not the first word. The first word is the Isle and the Trinity. They define the boundaries. If they don't define the boundaries, then there's nothing except God the Infinite. You know, that's what keeps, you know, most fundamentally we think of, that's what keeps the Father from becoming God the Infinite in everything. Because he bobbles himself up between the Paradise Trinity and the Paradise Isle. Can't go up, can't go down. He's bottled up. You know, and then just think about on the upper surface of the aisle. I mean, not only is he can't move in the center from his center point in the aisle, but it's like, well, could he kind of lean sideways? No, he's encased in the sun, so he can't move sideways. And it's like, well, maybe he could push against the sun a little bit. Okay, encase him in the spirit. Well, maybe he could push against, well, encase him in the functioning of the Paradise Trinity. Okay, he's completely encased. So that God the Infinite, the potential for God the Infinite, can't get out. Can't get out. You know, he couldn't be more buried in the universe.
Is that why? That seems to say why he is the first source and center.
Yeah, he's the first one to be centered. See. Right. See. Right. So, just, you know, when you think about the Father that way, it's a very different universe than just a big giant infinite container and a Father that's just randomly flitting about all over the place. I mean, how could there ever be order if such an incredible engine of creation was flitting about? I mean, it would just stir up the whole universe. He'd be like a giant stirring rod, you know, mixing up the whole universe of universes. He has to be completely anchored and contained. If any of his personality could get out here, if it wasn't so encased like that is there, on the, you know, then there wouldn't be a place for me to be a person. That's why he has no personal presence out here, because I need to have a place to be. If you let him have personal presence out here, then you have to give yourself up. There's no room for you then, okay? So he has no personal presence out here. And you can see, so philosophically, you see why. But then, you know, you can technically also see why. Because he can't get out. He's completely encased, you know? in force fields that keep him from getting out. He's locked in there. Yep.
But when you say he's, in a sense, beneath the Trinity,
yep,
and above the material,
yep, part of, yep, creation, yep.
But isn't God part of the Trinity?
No, see, that's you got to remember, there's the universal Father, the eternal Son, and the infinite Spirit. There's three things. And then there's the Paradise Trinity, a fourth thing. Paradise Trinity is not these three guys working together. That's the first triunity. The Paradise Trinity is a separate fact that, in the truest sense, is above the three of them. Yeah, that's also fifth epical revelation. Yeah, nothing before that. You know, we kind of had notions of a Paradise Trinity because it was revealed to us, you know, for 500,000 years. But never this direct recognition that it's not just a word that describes the three of them working together. The three persons working together. That's not what the Paradise Trinity is. It's a fourth fact.
Would you say it's antecedent?
Right, see, in that, fundamentally, what the revelation is here to do is to get us fully turned around and view things in the most proper sense, top down. And in that most proper sense, it is antecedent. It is the, you know, it's undivided deity. Right? So you have deity, part of which is undividable and part of which is dividable. And then you downstep that which is dividable and you have the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. And what's left above? The undividable deity, the Paradise Trinity. Okay, it's what's fundamentally at the top. You know, but you start by understanding. It's like, well, I have a relationship with the Father, so I got that, and then I add in the Son, and then I add in the Spirit, and then I think, okay, and then I could imagine a super additive consequence of the three. See, so I start. My initial touchstone with the Paradise Trinity is that bottom up, where I think of it as a super additive consequence. In the individuality viewpoint. But then they say, once you've taken that step, now flip it around and really understand it in its truer sense, top down. So don't start with God, bottom up. That's section two of the foreword. Start with deity, section one, okay? Paradise Trinity is not God. It's something greater than God. It's deity. See, that's revolutionary. What theology has ever tried to have some element in it that was greater than God? None. But the fifth epical revelation, that's the first thing it does, is tell you that there's something greater than God. Deity.
Says it right away.
Right. It's the very first thing it says. Okay. That's revolutionary.
Greater is a funny word,
though. Well, it is. But, see, I mean, yeah, right, but you get my point. I mean, yeah, greater in the sense of antecedent, higher. I mean, you know, if you're going to define God to be personalized deity, that definition doesn't have any meaning if deity doesn't exist before God.
Right,
it's prior. It's prior, see, it's antecedent, it's prior. Philosophically, see, this is a philosophic revelation, see, it's greater philosophically. It's not greater religiously, because, you know, but it's greater philosophically. And then you go, oh, that's right, philosophy is greater than religion. You know, I mean, science, you have science and religion on a plane, they're side by side. The super additive consequence is philosophy above them. See, that's why deity is above God in the top-down picture. Because philosophy is prior to, you know, to true religion is predicated on true philosophy. You can't get true religion from the bottom up. You can only get it from the top down through philosophy. You can't get true science from the bottom up. Everything we know right now is a case in point. The only way you can get true science is through philosophy. 100 years ago, we stopped trying to get to science through philosophy. We threw out the notion of philosophy. We decided it was, you know, imaginary. And we could just, you know, get science from the bottom up. And that's why almost all science is false. You can't get true science bottom up. You can only get it through philosophy, top down.
How come in the first sentence of the foreword,
says God, divinity, and deity, but God is first and is capitalized. Divinity is second, deity is third, and they're not, deity and divinity are not capitalized.
Right. Look at the context of it. It's saying words you've played with. You've played with the word deity. You never thought about capitalizing, not capitalizing, means something except self-aggrandizement. You know, you basically have the word deity, lowercase d, and you have the word divinity, lowercase d, and you have God, and you love to capitalize that word for obvious reasons. So they're saying you got those three words, but you're totally confused about what they mean.
They did that intentionally instead of mentioning deity first.
All right, like I said, once you get through the intro, the preface of the foreword, section number one is capital D, deity, right? Section number two is God. Right. And then when you get to, what is it, the third paragraph of the preface of the foreword, you know, they tell you what they're going to talk about in this revelation. And they don't say they're going to talk about God. They say they're going to talk about deity and reality. And the reality is a threefold actuality of things, meanings, and values. They tell you it's going to be a revelation of deity, things, meanings, and values. God. Yeah.
Isn't everybody rushes to the Jesus paper? And forward, everything you know is wrong.
Right. The forward, the first thing it does is turn your whole universe upside down. You know, if you are really reading it.
Yeah.
You know, if you just skip every, you know, if you just skip, look, you know, and wait till you see the word, oh, there's the word God, and you read that sentence.
Yeah.
You know, and then skip a ways. And, you know, how far do you have to skip in the foreword before you find the word religion? All the way past it. Word religion is not in the foreword. In the very last sentence, you get the word religious. Very last sentence. Okay, is it a religious text? I think if it was a religious text, the word religion would be in the foreword. Right. It's not a religious text. It's not fundamentally about God. It's about deity, and then through your recognition of deity, you can finally have a true relationship with God. Instead of an imaginary relationship with God that is predicated on you. There's me, and then there's that guy that's going to do my bidding, God. You know, and he taught me magical incantations that he can't ignore. And, you know, God is not your handmaiden. Okay, you know, they're trying to turn the whole, you know, that's the bottom up point of view. It's like, no, we're gonna turn that on its head. You know.
So back to the Father.
Yep.
The Father is well hugged and many layers.
Yes, fully embraced.
But isn't there one facet of the Father for each of us?
Mm-hmm. And think about how that picture,
that?
Yeah, think about how that picture painted on the aisle is the pattern. So he sends a fragment out. And they describe that fragment as being what in your mind?
Imprisoned
in your mind. Right. I mean, it's encased, just like he's encased. Because that's the whole point. That he's putting the adjuster in cooperative subordination to your will. What does it say in the adjuster papers? You know, it's an italicized sentence. The adjuster is always subservient to your will because it's modeled after the Father at the center of paradise, who's always subservient to the will of the Paradise Trinity. Okay, and encased. See, you know, that encasement, you know, that enshroudment, that, you know, whatever you want a word you want to use, investment, is the mother. Your mind comes from the mother, wrapped around that fragment of the Father, because the Father can't be directly exposed to the environment here. It's slurp it all up into God the Infinite. The mother is God with, you know, that's imminent within.
The interface.
Right. The mother can be directly exposed, and she won't swallow us all up. Because she's the all-are. She allows all. Now, the Father is rooted in the infinite one. She doesn't sound like it's going to allow much of anything except one. One infinite fact. You can't let that out. You can't let something that wants to be the infinite one out. Or that's all there will be is the infinite one. You got to keep it bottled up.
But yet we think of God as all powerful.
See, that's what I mean. It's throwing that old thing on its head. All powerful, yes, but it's like we think of a creator son as being the creator of a local universe. Yes, but following a plan of which he has no say in. Even all powerful. God is all powerful, omnipotent, but completely subject to pre-existent laws. He's all powerful within those laws, not outside of them. And he created them, right? He created the laws and put himself inside them, put himself subservient, because the laws, see, are really basically the nature of the whole, the Paradise Trinity. I mean, justice is applied law. Justice administration is one of the functions of the Paradise Trinity. See, he's subservient to those laws.
Yep. So, Chris, following the same pattern, mm-hmm. It's quite interesting. The same patterns in us.
Yep. Right?
So when we become one or fused with a thought or nature, mm-hmm. How does that pattern then manifest itself from the top down? In other words, I see the one you're talking about, mm-hmm. Being imprisoned. Now, when we become one with the thought of Jester, is it still imprisoned, or is it different?
Well, it's always the case that existential core, that virgin fragment, that raw fragment of the Father, is always enshrouded. I mean, even before you get your adjuster, that adjuster has an experiential nature that is acquired, wrapped around that existential core. See, even before... even a virgin adjuster, when it leaves the Divinnington, leaves with a little bit of experience that it acquired on Divinnington, which encases that existential core. It has to have that skin on it, or the Father would get out. See, once it left Divinnington, it would swallow up the whole universe. Right? It has to have a skin on it so that the existential thing can't come out and be everything. It's all... And then, of course, it's really handy because now it has an experiential nature and I'm an experiential being, so it can have a relationship to me. So it's always like that. I mean, what I'm really doing is wrapping my soul, my greater Marantia nature, around that core. We use the psychic circles, like the Vona circles. I get down to a first circler. If you think of the adjuster as a rod extending from infinity down into your mind, the first circler finally gets tight around that rod, okay? And then it tries to synchronize and it locks on. See, you're wrapped around the adjuster, and it's always that way. And slowly from here to eternity, you're letting more of that existential out. Just like we were talking about all these power beings, slowly letting the existential fact of the aisle out. See, it's the same pattern. And all of that is like, well, how do you know how much to let out, and when? And look to the Supreme. So if you have a Supreme adjuster, they really know how to be that proper governor. See, all these words are synchronized like this, that you can think about all this together. I mean, we could just go on for hours like this. Okay. See? Okay.
I've spent most of my life continue today to bridle against where I'm at and what I have to do, thinking, boy, if I was just free of all of these things I have to do, mm-hmm. what great things I could do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally false.
Right, it's totally 180 degrees. Your liberty, your true liberty is in law, despite what Lucifer tried to teach us all. which is the opposite. True liberty is in law. I mean, the universal Father is infinitely free because he's completely within law. That's what gives him his freedom. Without that law, he actually doesn't, you know, have freedom.
Anarchy.
You know, that's an illusion. You know, that's the, you know, of all the problems that have resulted from the Lucifer Rebellion, right? You know, that whole true and false liberty. That's the key, see? Because, you know, and that's why I'm stressing this so much about that cooperative subordination. Thinking what the Father did, he was achieving infinite liberation by putting himself in what, from our immature initial perspective, seems like infinite bondage. It's actually the opposite. You know, that law allows him to be free. Like I said, you know, to set your the absolute dimension of your personality free, you have to actually get to a place where there's absolute law in place, the Isle. Once you become a resident of the Isle, which has absolute law present, you finally can liberate the absolute dimension of your personality to express itself freely for the first time. It's only through those channels of law that free will can flow. It's the conduit through which will flows. Law and love are the same thing. You know, there is no difference between God is love and God is law. Those are the same statement. Just turning your hand around. It's one hand. This side is God is law, this side is God is love. It's one thing. It's the same thing. Law and love are equal words. Seen from a lowly perspective of a mortal that thinks that there's nothing more removed from matter than spirit. Like we're, you know, like we're talking about here, a creative spirit comes down and manipulates matter. Must not be too far removed. Right. There's a backdoor linkage where they're intimate, you know, where there is no distance between the two sides. It's just two sides of a thin sheet. One is matter and one is spirit. I mean, technically with, you know, with a father fragment, as we talk about, you know, if you lay all the father fragments out in front of you, you see pure spirit, quote unquote. If you flip them all around, you don't see any individuation. You see a continuum. It's called the force charge of space. They're the same thing. The force charge of space is pure energy, which is just the other side of pure spirit. I mean, think of that, the potential that gives you. Where there's no distance with that core that you've been given between the most rarefied physical thing, force, you know, and the most definitive spirit, rock solid thing. That there's no distance between those two. So what boundaries are placed upon your future? How much relationship could you have to a power personality synthesis? You know, where you not only are in an intimate, loving, personal relationship with all beings, but in an infinite pattern splendor with every ultimaton, with equal quality, just as intimate.
Contemplating the experience is something different.
Yeah. I mean, it's just as magnificent as you can imagine a perfect love connection. Imagine being able to feel all matter the same way. And it's all one. You get the first taste of that when you get to the Isle. And the difference between the substance of the Isle and the substance of the Eternal Son is a difference in name only. You know, one's the absolute of matter and the other's the absolute spirit. But they feel the same. They're both equally incredible. Just amazing to feel. You can't feel any difference between what you're standing on and what you're engaging when you're finding the Eternal Son for the first time as a person. They feel the same. I mean, so you're just immersed in this incredible symphony of things and beings. Yeah, that's what it's about. Right, and you're infinitely sensile, you know, practically. Yeah. All right. Yep.
So I just need to clarify about the Trinity, what John was saying.
Mm-hmm.
So on page 15, when it talks about the Trinity, mm-hmm. I'm going to go back and it just says, the Paradise Trinity, the eternal deity union of the universal Father, the eternal Son, the infinite Spirit.
Right, that's a bottom-up point of view.
Is existential right. in actuality, that all potentials are experiential. So in other words, it's the beginning. Just the it's like the energy pattern of it, and then from there, the universal Father, the eternal Son, the infinite. I don't quite understand the difference.
You're not gonna figure it out, you know, in 5 hours even sitting in this room with me talking about it. I mean, you know, it's a very, very huge step. Like I said, this is beyond any challenge that any human has ever been asked to do. This is so beyond what any religionist or any scientist has ever been asked to do, to understand what the revelation is saying. Like I said, there isn't anything that it doesn't completely turn 180 degrees around. You've got to completely reform your whole worldview. You've got to think about things you've never remotely thought about before. And it's not going to make any sense to begin with. It can't. If it made sense, it wouldn't be a revelation. It would be your diary. It's not the fifth epical diary. It's the fifth epical revelation. It isn't anything that anyone has ever thought or written before. Everything about it, once you engage it fundamentally as a truth fact, will be revolutionary. It will just completely blow your whole worldview out of the water. And when it's things that are a little bit remote, it's not so bad. But of course, the whole touches the things that are close right now. And that's why those truths are rugged. I mean, it turns things around you never thought about. But if you had, you would have had them backwards. But it also turns around things that you've thought a lot about, like prayer. Turns them completely around. You know, and that's scary to begin with. Courageous and independent cosmic. You have to have the courage to let the revelation turn all those things around. If you have the courage to let it do it, what you'll find when you've turned them around and synchronized with them is so much better than anything you had before. But that's a very fearful step for a little animal origin creature like us to take, to let the whole history of mankind's thought be turned around. Everything. Every theologian, every philosopher, every scientist to turn all that stuff around. All right, let's read some more. Okay. Oh, you got some too?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Maybe we'll read some more.
Maybe. Sue Lewis posted a couple comments. There's two. One, she was wondering, is there a way to see this in other times, in the archives? It's going so fast. There will be a total deity class coming up this fall again.
Mm-hmm.
And so if people want to get into that in a lot of depth,
right,
and take the proper time to get into it, that is going to be offered again. And then she also said, for her second point, in the forward section 5.5, it says, but the Isle of Paradise is non-prepersonalized, extra-spiritual. How can that be?
Well, again, we don't want to get too much into all those things. I mean, you know, when you have you start with a contrast between deity and reality. And the Isle of Paradise is the anchor in that second word. The Isle of Paradise is the center of infinity, lowercase I. Lowercase I infinity is the totality of reality. The Isle is the anchor point, the center of reality. And that's in contrast to deity, personalized or not. Yeah, so that's, so just kind of, see how that contrast is there. The Paradise Isle, the Paradise Trinity. One's, the center of reality, and the other is the whole of deity. Okay, see, so it's deity and reality. See, the Father and everyone, all of us exist between, are a dynamic fact between deity and reality. Okay, let's read some more.
Salvington, the headquarters of Nebadon, is situated at the exact energy mass center of the local universe. But your local universe is not a single astronomic system, though a large system does exist at its physical center.
Okay, so let's just quickly step through this. You can see it's a tiny little paragraph because they want to stop and think about a couple things here. Like I said, there's a center of gravity. You know, there's a wholeness gravitationally to a local universe. And that's what they're pointing out here. Let's think a little bit about this issue of not a single astronomic system. You know, like I said, sometimes, you know, it is. But definitely in our case, we need to understand it when it's not. That it's an aggregation. It's like, well, how complex an aggregation? I'll just tell you that in paper 41, when we eventually get there, the first sentence of section 3 in paper 41, which is old single column 458, says that there are upward of 2,000 brilliant suns pouring forth light and energy in Satania. Okay, and your sun is an average blazing orb. So they give you that little data point. You basically have 2,000 stars in our local system. So let's assume that our local system, you know, is relatively typical, and we can just multiply it up. So there's 10,000 local systems in a local universe. So if you assume there's 2,000 stars in each local system, then you've got 20 million stars to fill out a local universe. It's going to take 20 million stars. You know, and that is through those assumptions to make a local universe. It's like, well, up in paper 57, they tell you that our little Andromeda Nebula that our sun came from only made 1 million stars. So under those assumptions, if we need something like 20 million, that would mean the little Andromeda Nebula only, you know, amounted to 1/20th of the total local universe. You know, obviously there's, you know, a bunch of assumptions in there, but you know, it's one estimate, back of the envelope estimate of, you know, roughly how complicated it is. Okay, it could be quite complicated. You know, like, you know, if they were all the size of the Andromeda, it'd take 20 of those things collected together to make a local universe, kind of. So okay, we'll see in a little bit. We can add another back of the envelope calculation, kind of the other end point of putting some boundaries on that that estimate of what big of a fraction Andromeda Nebula is of the local universe of Nebadon. Okay, so there's that. But like I said, there is this, you know, exact energy mass center. You know, so there's a center of gravity. And it says that a large system does exist at its physical center. You know, is that just some sort of like gigantic dark island of space sort of a thing? Or is it literally some sort of massive, more, you know, maybe there was one of these big spiral galaxies, you know, that kind of ended up being the core of Nebadon, and then Andromeda Nebula was added to that, maybe. I mean, we don't really, you know, they don't explain. But there's some sort of a significant single physical system at the center, one way or another. So that obviously is going to lead to a center of gravity phenomenon for the whole local universe. Okay, so there's that point.
Salvington is the personal headquarters of Michael of Nebadon, but he will not always be found there. While the smooth functioning of your local universe no longer requires the fixed presence of the creator sun at the capital sphere, this was not true of the earlier epochs of physical organization. A creator sun is unable to leave his headquarters world until such a time as gravity stabilization of the realm has been effected through the materialization of sufficient energy to enable the various circuits and systems to counterbalance one another by mutual material attraction.
Okay, so they have this kind of elaborate description there of doing this initial physical stabilization of the local universe, where you're now injecting the influence of the Creator Son and the Creator Mother Spirit into the physical form, the physical arrangement of things. You know, and look at how they're telling you the creative energy of Michael gets fed into that process. You know, who's ubiquitous throughout Nebadon? And, you know, where do you plug into her? Where do you engage her? On Salvington, that's where she's centered and seated. You know, so he has to be there, plugged into her. So his creative energy is fed into her and then combined with hers and spread throughout the whole region and does whatever the heck it does. Obviously, we don't know exactly what they're talking about here, but they're telling you, see, that he's unable to leave because there's no way that he can be, he has to be feeding into those early stages, and that's the only place where you can plug in, or you can connect into the process, so he's fixed there. And I just remembered, you know, back in that third paragraph of the section, you know, one of the things they said is, the arrival of the living staff on the completed spheres, you know, after that billion years. You know, this whole time when he's there, fixed on Salvington, you know, they haven't created any angels or Melchizedek or anything like that. There's none of those beings. You got the power beings, okay, to keep him company. you know, and power centers, they're personal and stuff, you know. So, okay, there is that. But, you know, it said living staff, and we're not talking about the power beings there. Who's that staff?
Don't they come from another universe?
No, that's not it. It's a type of angel.
Yeah.
Do you remember what? The tertiaphim, right. There's 1,000 tertiaphim that come out, you know, and of course it takes them a long time to get out, you know, and like Creator, Son, and Creator, Mother, Spirit. But eventually they get out there. They get, you know, they've got 1,000,000 years of building architectural worlds. They got plenty of time to, you know, for a 200,000-year journey or whatever. Okay, they can get out there. You know, but so for that whole initial time when he's seated there, he at least has this 1,000 tertiaphim that, you know, he can interact with. That are not just personalities that are fixated on the material stuff like the power beings.
Manual there yet?
No. See, there's no one there yet. Just those 1,000 tertiaphim. Once they get started with the, you know, process of making their own beings, then the super universe beings come down and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. Okay, so that's what's going on. So he's a lot like the Father, see there. His feet are planted on Salvington. He can't move. I mean, he's probably literally right at the, you know, the node point of the Creative Mother Spirit's, or just Creative Spirit's presence. You know, right, yeah. He's just sort of melted himself into her, probably, and feeding himself into her presence for that period of time. Okay. You know, and so you kind of have, you know, he's Father and Son, so you have Father and Son, and she's Spirit. See, it's kind of a, like on the aisle with the three concentric presences. See? You can imagine that they're doing something like that at this stage, very literally. All right.
Presently, the physical plan of a universe is completed, and the Creator Son, in association with the Creative Spirit, projects his plan of life creation. Whereupon does this representation of the Infinite Spirit begin her universe function as a distinct creative personality. When this first creative act is formulated and executed, there springs into being the bright and morning star, the personification of this initial creative concept of identity and ideal of divinity. This is the chief executive of the universe, the personal associate of the Creator Son, one like him in all aspects of character, though markedly limited in the attributes of divinity.
Okay, we'll talk about a number of these things more in the, you know, as we go forward, but okay, the basic points, okay, when they start out, they're referring to what we'll read about at the beginning of paper 34, the primary eruption, when the Creative Spirit becomes a Creative Mother Spirit, and they actually start creating that retinue they were talking about, the first one of which is Gabriel, the bright morning star, and notice how they describe Gabriel is like the Creator's Son in all aspects of character. And we've talked about this. You have these two really primary sons in the local universe. You have the Bright Morning Star and you have the Father Melchizedek. The Bright Morning Star is a son that's like the Creator's Son. That other primary son, the Father Melchizedek, is a son that's like the Creative Mother Spirit. So you have those two primary sons, one like the Creator's Son, one like the Creative Mother Spirit. Those are the two flavors of sons, just like Adam's son and Eve's son. In other words, Adam, son of Adam, and Adam, son of Eve. You know, those are those two kids. One is like Eve and one is like Adam. You know, you have the same thing. You have Gabriel Ben Michael, see? And you have Father Melchizedek Ben, you know, Creative Mother Spirit, whatever you want to say there. Okay? See? Okay. But he's first, Gabriel's first, because you have this fundamental division of roles of the more direction-like and the more place-like. So the direction of Gabriel comes first. And then when they say, though markedly limited in the attributes of divinity. Okay, that last line about Gabriel. In a general sense, the word divinity means deity likeness. And you have two basic ways that you could have deity likeness. If you have deity, obviously it has the characteristic of deity likeness. So if it's deity, divinity is a given. But you can also have something that isn't deity, that is divine. Gabriel is not deity. He's not a creator being. He's not God. He's not personalized deity. Okay? So, markedly limited, yes. See, his divinity is not the divinity that's just directly because he's deity. Okay, that's what that's referring to. He is a being that can procreate. He and the Father Melchizedek, for instance, procreate together. But he's not a creator. So he's a divine procreator, but not a creator, not personalized deity, not God. All right, more here.
And now that the right-hand helper and chief executive of the Creator's Son has been provided, there ensues the bringing into existence of a vast and wonderful array of diverse creatures. The sons and daughters of the local universes are forthcoming, and soon thereafter the government of such a creation is provided, extending from the supreme councils of the universe to the fathers of the constellations and the sovereigns of the local systems. The aggregations of those worlds, which are designed subsequently to become the homes of the varied mortal races of willed creatures. And each of these worlds will be presided over by a planetary prince.
Read that next little one too.
And then, when such a universe has been so completely organized and so repletely manned, does the Creator Son enter into the Father's proposal to create mortal man in their divine image?
Okay. So you can see, you know, basically sort of between the lines, you know, they refer to the supreme councils of the universe. You can see, John, how they're not only are you creating the local universe beings, but the unions of days, the faithfuls of days, you know, all those, you know, assigned sentinels, associate inspectors, all those beings from above, you know, are going to come in and engage it too. Okay, so all that gets put into place. See, so again, you know, we're in this range from 300 billion years ago to 200 billion years ago. Then all these beings are coming into place, and you're finally then going to start up the evolution on the first material spheres and eventually get will creatures. Okay, so look at what the pattern is here. And they talked about it in the proper order even, or in the same order, because that's the natural order. First, we talked about power, like paper 29. Now we just talked about setting up the order, like paper 30. And then what's the last little paragraph there, the footnote of it? Ascension. Ascending mortals. So that's the pattern. Power plus order equals ascension. Okay, it's just like we saw the last three papers of part one. We've just seen them lay it out in the first paper of part two here. Power, order, ascension. We'll talk a little bit here. That basic picture of laying out all the beings, they even said here, the sovereigns of the local systems. So, you're left to kind of speculate. It's like, well, okay, so how did this work? I mean, obviously, Andronover, was still in a very early stage, long before you would have had Satania, way back here prior to 200 million years ago. So, one can wonder, it's like, well, these first local systems, where they've built the architectural worlds and they're going to have these first inhabited worlds, I mean, I guess you'd have to assume that those, are somewhere in that central region, apparently, I guess. Since they said that there was this large system that does exist as at the physical center, I guess that's probably what we'd be talking about. I mean, the simplest assumption that they've set up some of those early systems in inhabited worlds somewhere not too far from Salvington. Maybe in literally one of the constellations that's butting right up against Salvington in the worlds. We don't exactly know how that is. There like a District of Columbia sort of a thing around the local universe headquarters, is there some kind of like little region,
Stan Hartman thought it was Antares.
Now with that, as long as you brought up Antares, the most likely place to fit Antares into the picture, and you go, why Antares? Why not Aldebaran or something? The reason is Antares itself, the primary, is not only a red supergiant. It's many hundreds of times bigger than the diameter of the sun. If you put it in the solar system, it's
450 times.
I think I've seen even bigger than that. I think I've even seen numbers like 800 times.
60 million times.
It'd be more. It's like the orbit of Mars. Or even bigger. Okay, it's this great big giant, it's over 10 solar masses, I think. But the thing is, that's a binary system. You got another one that's like in the 10 solar mass range too. So you obviously had a very massive thing that was so big it couldn't be one, and it split apart into two, and both of them are really huge. And it's also very suspicious because it's very close to the ecliptic. Okay. If you think about the Andronover Nebula, okay, there's an angular momentum of the Andronover Nebula and all the stars that then go with it. You have basically a plane. The ecliptic, coincidentally, is not too far from the sun's equator. Just happened, and the Angana system went by. So if you see stars that are kind of close to the ecliptic, close to the plane of the solar system, and that's the equator of the sun, and basically kind of the plane of the Andromeda Nebula, you can wonder if one of those big stars might be that residual core of the Andromeda Nebula that they tell you about. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. If I had a guess, it's just so suspicious. It's very likely, let's say it that way, that Antares is that residual core of the Andromeda Nebula. But remember what we've just been going through. That may be only a 20th of Nebadon. Okay, so it's not the center of Nebadon, but it is the center, most likely, of the residual Andromeda Nebula. See, and that's like, I've been really stressing this because a lot of readers in the past haven't gotten this clear. know, they've thought that the Andromeda Nebula was all of Nemedon. It's like, no, just look at the simple numbers. There's only a million stars. It's not even close to being big enough to be the whole Nemedon. Right? All right, so...
How far is Antares from?
And it's about the right distance you expect. It's a few hundred light years. Mm-hmm. So, you know. And again, there always could be issues with that stuff. But, you know, everything about it is pretty suspicious. Of all the ones I know, that's the most likely one to be that residual. Because they tell you there is a very large, you know, core of gas of the Andromeda Nebula that remained. And so, yeah.
I know I like to look up at it.
Yep.
Looking in the right direction.
Yeah, and so, you know, you can wonder, you know, if, you know, there's all these different angles. You know, how close is that to the, if you look towards the center of the Andromeda Nebula, how close is that to maybe being kind of towards the center of Nemedon? I don't know. But, you know, at least, even if it's not looking basically towards the center of Nemedon, you know, right next door is Sagittarius. You know, right next to Scorpio. You know, and so it's at the very least in the field of view. You're looking towards the center of all things when you look towards, you know, basically when you look towards Antares. So. Okay, let's get some more here.
The organization of planetary abodes is still progressing in Nemedon, for this universe is indeed a young cluster in the starry and planetary realms of Orvinton. At the last registry, there were 3,840,101 inhabited planets in Nemedon, and Satania, the local system of your world, is fairly typical of other systems.
Okay, so you know, you see why they put the parenthetical indeed in there. You know, we're a long ways from 10 million. Yeah, 38% here. Right, we're not even halfway there. Okay, 38% here. So we're quite young, you know. But notice what they did. They did add to our assumption. They said that you can assume that the local system is, you know, fairly typical of the other systems. So that kind of helps with. It's like, well, maybe that estimate that we made about what fraction the Andromeda Nebula might be of all the stars. You know, there seems to be some validity there that, of making that extension, that extrapolation. Okay, and in the next paragraph, we're going to do that again. So read that next one.
Satania is not a uniform physical system, a single astronomic unit or organization. Its 619 inhabited worlds are located in over 500 different physical systems. Only five have more than two inhabited worlds. And of these, only one has four peopled planets, while there are 46 having two inhabited worlds.
Okay, we're going to get to the second part, complicated part second, just that initial statement. Satania is not a uniform physical system, a single astronomic unit or organization. They actually give you the specifics up in section 2 of paper 41. I don't know if you want to look there, you can. It's page 457 in the single column, paper 41, section 2, paragraph 2. Satania itself is composed of over 7,000 astronomical groups or physical systems. So yeah, definitely not a single. 7,000 physical systems, few of which had an origin similar to that of your solar system. The astronomic center of Satania is an enormous dark island of space, which, with its attendant spheres, is situated not far from the headquarters of the system government. You know, so there, you know, you've got upward of 2,000 stars, but when you just talk about different types of physical systems, it's more like 7,000 instead of 2,000, because you throw in dark islands and giant gaseous nebulae and, you know, who knows what. All, you know, all the various things that are kind of a separate physical system, there's about 7,000 of them. So, yeah, it's not a single astronomic unit or organization like they're saying here in paper 32. Now let's do a little quick math, okay, with that rest of that paragraph. So you have 619 inhabited worlds. Okay, and they give you, there's one star system, you know, that has four inhabited worlds. And then, you know, seems reasonable to assume that there's four then that have three. So one that has four, four that has three. So that's the five that they say that have more than two. And then there's 46 that have two. I say, well, okay, so how many physical systems have just one inhabited world?
The remainder.
Right, the remainder, but let's just figure that out. Okay. So so that's total up how many worlds are in these multiple... Hold on, one step at a time. How many multiple worlds in this... So you have 46 that have two. It's very easy, just step through. 46 that have two, so that's 92 worlds, inhabited worlds there. Okay, and then there's four that have three, so that's 12 more, so that's 104. Okay, and then there's one that has four, so that's 108. So then the multiple ones, you have 108 of the 619. So there's 511, right, that have star systems that have just one inhabited world. Okay, so there's 511 of the over 500 that they're talking about. Let's get the actual total. So you have 511, and seeing you have 46 and 5, so that's 51. So how many do you have? 562. All right. So over 500, it's actually 562. So you can do a little math here. So 562 physical systems give you 619 inhabited worlds. There's a ratio there of physical systems to inhabited worlds. If you divide those two, you'll see it's 0.9. 0.9 physical systems per inhabited world. Okay, now they said that our local system's fairly typical again, so, you know, so you can just kind of make some rough guesses here. I mean, so a physical system that has an inhabited world has to have at least, you know, one star. So the minimum is, okay, there's, you know, you have one star there. So, you know, let's kind of get a minimum number here. We need 10 million inhabited worlds. Times 0.9, that ratio of physical systems to inhabited worlds. So I've got 9 million. You know, in that essence, you need at least 9 million stars to perpetuate that ratio, to extend that ratio to the whole local universe. Okay, so that's giving us kind of another endpoint. Obviously, you know, there may be, I'm sure a number of those inhabited systems have more than one star. But at least, you know, there's at least one. Okay. So it's a minimum. You need at least 9 million stars. Okay, so in that estimate, the Andromeda Nebula is only 1/9 still. See, it's still only 1/9 of what you need. So somewhere between 1/20 and 1/9 seems to be what these are suggesting, is what ratio Andromeda makes up of the whole local universe. Okay.
You would have, I'm sure, many stars that don't have any.
Right, so it's all these things. I mean, we're just trying to make some rough, you know, just to give us some sense. You know, is Andromeda?
And there's only 3 million. So they've been saying out of the 10 million, so well, 38%. So there's only 3.8 million out there. So of the ones that are out there,
right? Like for instance, you got about 200 inhabited worlds. You know, in waiting in the bullpen in Satania. You know, they're getting ready, you know, especially, you know, a few of them are getting ready for life implantation. You know, right. See, so, you know, 200 stars that are really close to us, see, don't have any inhabited worlds yet. They haven't even gotten life implantation yet. You know, so these are a lot of stars that, you know, you could look up the name of. You know, I mean, we've named most of these really close stars. You know, they literally have an Arabic name or something, right? You know, okay. Right. So a lot of stars, you know, even locally, don't have any inhabited worlds yet. Yeah, you got some?
About what kind of distances between stars?
You're talking, you know, several light years.
Several.
You know, basically. You know, especially if it's kind of in, you know, in a normal sort of background density.
Out here.
Right.
Just one thing.
Yep.
We have two inhabited
planets, right?
That's my speculation, that we're one of those 46 that has two. The other one is in non-breather world.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be more than interested.
Right, that whole bit about. But
God forbid that we come on this
one. Yeah, and just, I mean, to Vaughn, your point, I actually did that one time. You know, if you take the closest 50 stars to the Earth, they're within 16 light years, okay, from us. So you can get an average spherical density. And so you say, well, how to get 2,000 stars for Satania, how big a spherical volume would I need? I'd need a volume with a radius of 55 light years. Well, to get a constellation, I'd need a spherical volume of 250 light years radius. To get a local universe, I'd need a spherical volume of a radius of 1,200 light years. 1,200 light year radius, 1,200 light year radius. Or another 2,400 light year diameter. If you just take that average density and assume it's a spherical volume. So that gives you some idea, see, of kind of the sizes. Another rough way to just rough estimate the sizes. Again, there's a zillion assumptions there, but a little bit of a back of the envelope idea of how big we're talking about here. Okay. All right, so let's get the rest of it here.
The Satania system of inhabited worlds is far removed from Uversa and that great sun cluster, which functions as the physical or astronomic center of the seventh super universe. From Gerasim, the headquarters of Satania, it is over 200,000 light years to the physical center of the super universe of Orvinton, far, far away in the dense diameter of the Milky Way. Satania is on the periphery of the local universe, and Nebadon is now well out towards the edge of Orvinton. From the outermost system of inhabited worlds to the center of the super universe is a trifle less than 250,000 light years.
Okay. So you see how there when they say that that Satania is on the periphery of the local universe, it kind of just adds to this idea that you've got probably the really big thing system at the center, and then Andromeda is one of the things that was added on. It's kind of in the outer margins of Nebadon. Okay, and then get yourself oriented here. When they say that the Satania system of inhabited worlds is far removed from Uversa, and that great sun cluster which functions as the physical or astronomic center of the seventh super universe, what's that quote unquote great sun cluster in the Milky Way galaxy? It's the central bulge, It's the big central bulge of the Milky Way galaxy. That's what they're talking about. Uversa is there. When they talk about far, far away in the dense diameter of the Milky Way, we're in the disk of the Milky Way, and so you got you see that band of the Milky Way across the sky because you're looking in the plane of the disk. In the center of that, you can see the central bulge. Okay, that's in the direction of Sagittarius. You're looking towards Uversa. All right, and then they give us a disclosure of fact that from Satania to the center of the Milky Way galaxy is 200,000 light years. And you go, oh, that's just a straightforward fact statement. Did they violate the revelatory mandate giving us that? Is that something that we've figured out?
No.
Very, very recently even. Now, we're getting quite sophisticated in our estimates now of how far it is from the sun to the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And the best estimate with all this advanced technology now gives the answer of 27,000 light years. Okay, so have they violated the revelatory mandate? No, this is obviously something that we cannot figure out on our own. With our advanced technology and decades of working on this, we're still way off. 27,000 light years. It's actually 200,000. Okay. So that's why that can be there. 250. No, 200 from the sun to the center, from us to the center.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
200. Okay. 200 from us to the center. Okay. See, you've just, you know, this is an example. The only reason they could give us this is because we cannot figure it out on our own. This sentence couldn't be in here if our number was 200,000.
It's actually from Jerusalem, right?
Yeah. Right, but it's just a handful of light years from, you know, a few light years from here to Jerusalem. I mean, like I said, that estimate, the biggest, the radius, you know, could be there is 55 light years. Okay. 200,000 minus 55
is... So the diameter of the Milky Way is 500,000 light years.
Right, and that's the other thing. You know, so the diameter, see, is about 500,000 light years, they're saying here. So that must not be something we can figure out either. What do we think? Well, we think something like 100 to 120,000. Okay. All right, no, off by a factor of five. Okay. Right.
So this is on topic, but not, this question is, the paradise, or, excuse me, the dark gravity bodies.
Yeah, yeah.
Are they on the other, and we're on the outer side.
Yep, yep.
They're on the inside.
Right.
Okay, so they're beyond 500.
Right, yeah, so. Yeah, maybe. You know, for, I mean, if it's, let's say you give, give a 50,000 light year buffer. Okay, so that's 300,000 to the center then from the dark gravity bodies and another 200. See, that's 500,000 light years away then.
So to get there from Eversa when you travel or when you get in Seraphim, you have to go all the way through the other side of...
Right. Yeah.
By the time we get there, maybe we'll be around.
Right. Yeah, remember, we talked about that journey, you know, and you get there and you look back and see how things are going. Well, yeah, a lot of time has passed, okay? That's why you look back and see how things are going. Yeah, you know, maybe 100,000 years have passed while you were traveling. See? Okay. Right. So those two numbers here are very important. They're giving us the two numbers that we need to calibrate our science. I mean, I'm sure we can come up with precise methods of figuring out distances, but we obviously can't get an accurate one. We have no way to properly calibrate it. Obviously, we're getting way the wrong answer. Okay, so this allows us to calibrate our science. This is something they can tell us.
I just want to make a quick comment that some UV readers believe that science is right and the book is wrong after they hear what the... So that's just kind of crazy.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You can believe anything. What are we to do? All right.
The universe of Nebadon now swings far to the south and east in the superuniverse circuit of Orvinton. The nearest neighboring universes are Avalon, Hensalon, Sansalon, Portalon, Wolvering, Fanoving, and Alvering.
Okay, so the first sentence there, just, you know, as we've been talking about, we all know this, longtime readers, you know, because the seventh super universe is starting to swing up, you know, towards the northerly track, you know, we're kind of in the southeast, you know, and so that's why when you look towards Eversa, you're also looking through towards the central universe, you know, because we're kind of on that outside in the same line. Okay, so there, you know, that's how we know that, is that statement that lines up the center of the Milky Way basically with the center of all things, just by coincidence right now. And then, you know, I haven't figured out the etymologies of those seven superuniverse, or local universe names. Very fascinating. You notice there's four lons and three ings, those suffixes. Okay, and it's obviously Northern European. Okay.
Sounds like the Lord of the Rings.
Right, right. That's what I said. It's obviously Northern European. The beings that live in Alvering, I don't think are related to Halvor. Pretty sure my relatives don't come from there, distant relatives. But, you know, just the fact, see, I'm Halvor and that's Alvor. I mean, yeah, okay, we're definitely talking about Northern European here, see. This is Andite, you know, Teutonic, Germanic, okay, I mean, you know, and why, you know, what, you know, I haven't figured these out. I'd love to figure these out sometime. I've played with them some, I haven't gotten anywhere. But, you know, you can, some things that are immediately kind of curious, you know, I mean, we have the whole King Arthur, mythology with Avalon, you know, and in that mythology, you know, that Northern European mythology, what direction does Avalon lie when people go there? You know, just like at the end of the Lord of the Rings, what direction do they all set sail? To the west. Okay. Is Avalon the local universe that's immediately to the west of Nevadon?
Might be. The closest one we know.
Yeah, and we know that we're intimately related. You know, they help us a lot. Or did, you know,
a
lot.
We use their surgeons from
time. Yeah, occasionally we use their surgeons, yes. Right. So there's, you know, and then the other thing to note there is, see, obviously they're giving you some description tied to these seven that's distinct. Whereas with Nebadon, you know, so it doesn't end with Lon or Ing. Okay, and that's because, like all of those primary names, like Orvinton, Nebadon, you know, all these names, the etymology there is just about the ascension scheme. Those are given English names just relative to our ascension scheme. Nebadon means first nebular upland. Dawn, upland. I mean, you know, you climb up in the local universe and you get to the first little plateau, first upland. A breather, and then you start climbing again. Okay. You know, it's named, all those names are relative to the ascension scheme, you know, for us. But obviously, you know, these other ones are, they're trying to tell us something, and what it is, I don't know.
I have a speculation.
Yes.
Speculate away. Well, it's interesting that Nevadon is ruled by a more sun-like creator sun.
Mm-hmm.
And Hensalon would fit along probably those lines as well. If there happens to be a correlation between giving freedom, you know, wider latitude of freedom to the beings, because we know there's more rebellion in Hensalon than even in Nevadon, and we're second in the list in Armanta.
Mm-hmm.
That perhaps that on suffix does relate to more sun-like creator suns, and perhaps the ing suffix relates to more father-like, the king creator suns.
Well, you see, you know, the thing about, you know, Lon is kind of, you know, see, I think it's probably Lon and not on is probably the suffix. And it basically means island. And ing, you know, means, you know, you use it in, you know, like spiriting, and then, you know, it means of a specified kind. You know, but, you know, wolvering, that's like wolf hunter kind? No, that doesn't make any sense. Well, I mean, I don't know what to do with these words. But yeah, see, though, I mean, they must be doing something like that. They must be trying to, you know, the fact that there's four and three, it's got to be some big pattern like that. I agree, but what? I haven't figured out yet. I don't know.
Chris, can you just repeat what Nebadon means?
Oh, you can look it up in the etymology. Just look it up in the etymology, online. Just look, yep. It means first nebular upland. But, you know, the etymology is in the library. Just, you know, look it up in the etymology. Okay. All right, let's get this last paragraph here.
But the evolution of a local universe is a long narrative. Papers dealing with the super universe introduce this subject. Those of this section, treating of the local creations, continue it, while those to follow, touching upon the history and destiny of Urantia, complete the story. But you can adequately comprehend the destiny of the mortals of such a local creation only by a perusal of the narratives of the life and teaching of your creator son, as he once lived the life of man in the likeness of mortal flesh on your own evolutionary world.
Okay, so the first part there, notice we actually did it tonight. We went back and pulled some stuff out of part one, to talk about this. We obviously were doing this stuff here in part two, and I had to go forward to part three to bring that in, just like they're saying. You know, if you want the whole picture of how this local universe, you know, all these details come together, you got to put together pieces in all three parts. Just exactly like they said. They purposely spread it out like that. And then that question that many people have had about, or even belief that many people have had, maybe I should say, that part four is not essential to the fifth epical revelation per se, that it's an appendix, it's added on. Okay, is that what it says here in part two? No, it says that, but you can adequately comprehend the destiny of the mortals of such a local creation. I think that's probably important for the fifth epical revelation, origin, history, destiny. Okay? So you can comprehend the destiny only. Okay? The fifth epical revelation is by definition incomplete without part four. And of course, also, it is part of the fifth epical revelation. Don't put new wine in old wineskins. Don't interpret part four with the fourth epical revelation eye. Okay, it's part of the fifth. And you see that very obviously when you start out in part four. The very first thing they tell you about the bestowals is that Michael is going to put himself in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity. That's what that story is about. It's about someone putting themselves in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity. Yeah, as the seventh one, he's consecrating his will to the will of the Father. But in the other six, he didn't. Because all seven together are consecrating his will to the overarching will of the Paradise Trinity, which is greater than the will of the Father, the will of the Son, the will of the Spirit, the will of the Father, Son, etc. Okay? It's all that together. You got to see it in that proper context. Don't limit it. Don't fixate on the Father. Don't pull the Father out of the hole. Keep him in the hole and understand the story in the context of the hole, what he's doing. You know, and then this, you know, and then remind yourself of this. You can adequately comprehend the destiny of the mortals of such a local creation only through that. You're reading through that. That's what you're trying to do. You're not trying to figure out, you know, which apostle did this or that. Okay. You're trying, you know, look for the truth. The truth that's flowing through that, they tell you, is this. You know, that by perusing those narratives, you can adequately comprehend the destiny of yourself in the local universe. That's what you're looking for there. Okay? That should really change your whole modus operandi in reading those pages. Right? Okay.
Yeah, but if you read the first three parts, it's a lot easier to comprehend that destiny than just reading the fourth.
Of course, yeah. And that's, of course, that's the whole point. It's the part four of a four-part story. And it needs to be told in that order, like they tell you in paper 19, section 1. The only way to understand the fifth epical revelation, in other words, the only way to understand, the only way to get this comprehension they're talking about out of part 4 is by engaging it top down. If you try to engage part 4 bottom up or thinking it's at eye level, something like that, you're not going to get this. They tell you the only way is to engage things top down. So that's what you're striving for. Try to, you know, transform your relationship to part four. Make it part of the fifth epical revelation. Don't limit it to the initial struggles of a handful of fishermen to understand the universe of universes. Don't limit yourself to that. And the fifth epical revelation is telling you it's time to put that in your foundation and do something with it now. Peter and James and John and Paul, they can teach you how to be a child of God. But what do you do with your childhood? You mature it into adulthood. Do something with what they started. Don't just, you know, imprison yourself in the fourth epical revelation. Don't limit yourself to that starting point. You know, and so when you interpret those sentences, don't just interpret them in that 2,000-year-old context. Put them in this bigger context. That's the point. All right, let's take a moment here.